upeka, or equanimity. I have to say from the start that I approach this subject with some degree of hesitation, because my history has been, when I was very early on in my practice, for my teachers to use that word almost within every sentence of every Dharma talk. And I never felt like I had enough. I still don't. And it was something, it caused a kind of stir, or a sort of, where do I go to get that? How do I find that? It felt to me like a place of neutrality. It felt to me like a place in which I was unaffected. It felt a little bit dry and desert-like, somewhat cold and inhumane. And I was at a loss to see how a place of equanimity could be held with any degree of love or affection. And so I constantly tried to get to the place of equanimity, to seek it out in my mind. I would have pain, and as much as I would try to find that place of equanimity of pain, I rarely could. Mostly I was up and down with the intensity of that pain. And there was a lot of inward struggle around my relationship with that word. And so since then I don't use it much, as you probably realize and recognize. Because as I practiced more and more, there are places within consciousness that are cave-like and actually give you that kind of remote passivity to what is occurring in front of you. Almost a dispassionate caring. And I've experienced those places with some degree of depth. And I just realized that once the mind formulates an idea or concept around how to work with a problem and call it something like equanimity, then the consciousness will find a place where that dispassion is held. It seeks out its intention. And still find that many Dharma teachers use equanimity, and perhaps it's just my conditioning in reference to that word, but it almost seems as if it's somewhere else than in the middle of it all. So I want to be very cautious, and that's my caution to you all, that this is not in anywhere else but in the middle of it all. And I think of the phrases, when they can be understood properly, so I'd just like to read a couple of those phrases and then just explore them just for a moment. I care about you, but cannot keep you from suffering. Now there, the caring is essential to equanimity, because without that you do have the dry dispassion. I care about you. I'm affected by your suffering. But I realize, I understand the nature of suffering, the cause of suffering. And that understanding keeps me from trying to caretake your suffering. Do you see the difference between that and finding a space that's unaffected in yourself? You see the limits of your power. You see the limits of your activity. It doesn't keep the heart from wishing it, caring, metta, cares that you or I hurt. But it realizes, perhaps unlike the person who is suffering, that it's not due to external factors. No matter what. No matter the fact if you have cancer or a heart attack or had an automobile accident. It seems as if the suffering is due to external factors. The pain may be due to external factors, but not the suffering, not the reaction, not the fear response. But it doesn't keep the heart from coming forward. And mostly, we don't understand the cause of suffering. And so what we do is we try to be caretakers of each other. And so doing, we get enmeshed. Our caretaking enmeshes us within the problem itself. Now we don't know whether we're part of the problem or where the problem ends and where we begin, or whether we can do something for the problem, because the whole thing is so confusing, so mixed up, so entangled in our need to rush in and do something, that in fact the person who is suffering is equally as confused by your rushing in. What is the cause of suffering? If we don't understand the second noble truth of the Buddha, then all of our activities will be from that enmeshed, from more enmeshment, more confusion. What is the cause of suffering? Resistance. Internal resistance is the cause of suffering. Not surrendering to the conditions of the moment. Now, how can we force someone to surrender to the conditions of the moment? We can't. And when we really begin to see that mostly we don't surrender to the conditions of the moment, if we're honest, because we don't truly believe that that's the cause of suffering. Living with the second noble truth so that it becomes so embedded in our understanding, so that the moment there is a flinch, a reaction, there is an equal assertion of understanding to relax, to release yourself from this, to not resist. But how many of us do that? Not very often. We may remember it once a day on Tuesdays. The day after the Monday when we have the homework. So you can see the problem with equanimity. What we really would like to do is one of two things. Lose ourselves in the other person's suffering and thereby validate our need to help, or dismiss it. In interviews, somebody will lay out their profile of suffering. And it can be horrendous. And I can tell by how they lay it out that they're expecting me to do something about it. I have a lump on my breast. My father is dying of... my dog just died. I've got food poisoning from today. I mean, it's on and on and on. And then they look up. Like, okay, now what are you going to say to take this away from, you're the Mr. Fix-It man, like Mr. Goodwrench. And there's not too much, I mean, how would I possibly know what to do? How would I possibly know what to do? My spiritual work is not a 911 call. You call 911 for 911. It's not even therapy in that sense. There has to be enough grounded stability for the exploration of the cause to be known. We have to be able to assume responsibility and accountability for the conditions of our life. And mostly, we rush in. And we get an enormous sense of personal satisfaction and reputation and status from rushing in. Call Mary. She'll be there like a... When somebody's in need, call Mary. I'm just picking that name out, Mary. So, and we get a feeling, yeah, I'm the one. Just call me anytime, night or day, call me. You notice I don't give out my phone number. Because that's enmeshed. To understand the limitations is an essential part of service and helping, it seems to me. So what equanimity does is that it grounds the idealism of metta, right? Metta is like may all beings, and then you're just like rushing forth like a gushing geyser, you know. Oh, no, yes, can I do anything for you? No. Mm-mm. Now be careful, because it can sound cold or dismissive or backing away. And that is not what's happening here. It's the understanding of where the problem arises and one's limits and being able to do anything about that. We really have no control over someone else's happiness. And yet, I can imagine what it must feel like to be a parent and to see your child go through the inevitable ups and downs of life. And you feel the impotency of being able, and you know they're running headlong into a wall, and you know that they have to run headlong into that wall. So what does equanimity bring to metta? Because equanimity fathers all the other Brahmaviharas. It grounds and roots the other Brahmaviharas so that they have some stability in reality. So when we bring equanimity of that understanding to metta, the open-hearted wish, may all beings be happy. At the same moment we wish that, which is the display of the heart, there's the understanding that happiness cannot be persuaded through a wish. And that I have very limited control over your happiness, although I may wish for it. And so what it brings to metta is patience. Without equanimity, metta, love, without the ground, is both idealistic and somewhat manipulative, forceful, willful. Imposed. Whether you want it or not, I'm going to help you. What does equanimity bring to karuna, compassion? remembering that compassion is the natural expression of heart when it contacts pain. But that expression of heart when it contacts pain must be rooted and grounded with equanimity, or compassion again turns into a kind of display of pity or piety. But with the groundedness of equanimity, I can then hold the pain that is there, allowing my heart to feel even greater empathy and my compassion. If I can't hold your pain, then compassion isn't rooted in the understanding of pain, but in the reaction to it. And therefore, compassion very quickly turns into an aversive response to pain because I can't hold it. And that aversive response to pain can be all the many things that we say and cliches that we say to people so that we don't have to experience their pain any longer. Like when you're in grief and you say, well, you know, you need to get over this thing. You need to get on with your life. We say these things, don't we? And that's because we can't hold their grief. We don't have the ability to hold their pain. And so we, in the aversion, which is the inability to hold it, we dismiss it or want them to get over it because that's what we want. Get over it and get on, and then I will befriend you again. That's really what we're saying. So what is equanimity offer mudita? The joy, the expression of joy at another person's happiness or success. When love touches someone succeeding or having a happy occasion, there is just this joy of seeing that person happy. But unless that joy is grounded in equanimity, then it turns into judgment or comparison or envy for that joy. So equanimity is the foundation or the root or the stabilizing component of all heart's activities. But you can't have equanimity without heart. And that's what many of us would like to have. Just equanimity. Because having heart means you're going to be affected, means there's going to be an interplay there, an exchange that goes on. And many of us would just as soon not have to bother with that. You know, I was in Burma, and I was doing many, many years of very solitary and intense practice, and I had ordained as a monk, and the Burmese tradition is very strenuous. And these aspects of mine, like equanimity, surface. And what I had been doing is Burmese, they just are full of meat on there. They just give you a lot of meat. And I was sitting there with my monk's bowl, having all this meat given to me on this table. And I would take the meat and I would tuck it back in my bowl. And then I would go outside and feed that meat to these wat dogs that were the most mangy animals that you can imagine. Many of them dying. All they ate ever was white rice because that's all anyone ever gave them to eat. So you can imagine what an animal would look like when it has just been eating white rice. So I just couldn't stand the pain of those dogs. And the Burmese lived with them every day. To them, that's what a dog looked like. And so I would go out and I would give them the meat. I was popular with the dogs, but not with the other monks. And one of the other monks, who was in charge of the Westerners, at this time Burma, and we were the first, myself and another Westerner were the first Westerners in Burma in half a century, or since World War II. And so they were very suspicious of us, and they had one monk follow us around, this is absolutely true, sticking his head in to see if we were sitting and, you know, just and looking in. All of a sudden you see this head looking in. And so he came charging out, and he just ridiculed me. And he could speak very good English for giving this meat to the dogs. But my practice at that particular moment, mostly if I weren't in that state of imposed non-caring. So this is what I'm calling the state. As the practice deepens in terms of this particular style, you get to a point where you are unaffected. There's a state where you are absolutely unaffected. Someone could say to you, your father died, and you'd go, okay. So he was just, and I was just, okay. Now, I couldn't believe it, that what I was, I mean, a part of me who remembers who I was prior to that state knew that I should be just devastated because he was a very senior monk and he was, you know, and I was a new monk and all that stuff. And it showed me how little caring a component quality of mind can hold. I really didn't care what he was saying. And I cared nothing about him. And I think more than anything, I was shocked by the lack of caring, by the lack of being affected, by just not being in touch. Because, just some personal stories, when I was a young man growing up as a child, in my preteen years, there was a lot of ruckus in the house, a lot of scolding, a lot of argument, a lot of yelling. And I found a place inside of me that I could go and be untouched. Very close, I think, to kind of dissociation. In fact, I talked to a psychiatrist one time who was out of course, and I told him about that. He said, well, you were very close to dissociating when you were young. So for me, and again, I'm not saying this as an absolute, but for me, that sense of equanimity can move into a kind of a dissociated style or stance. That is not life being lived. Let us be very clear that that is not where the practice takes us. So then, when we realize that we have to bring the heart into the equanimity, into the equanimity, into the equanimous quality, then it means that you don't in any way shield yourself from the intensity and volatility of the emotional display inside oneself. It's not a backing away to a neutral corner. It's not a boxing match. And so how to blend both the willingness to be totally intimate and affected by life, and yet at the same time to know one's limitation and to be able to put it down, to put down, to rest with that. Well, then I changed the word equanimity to understanding. Because for me, the mechanism of true equanimity is understanding. One's understanding, clarity. Where does my wish for you to be out of pain and my ability to take you out of pain, where are those things in conflict? Not to stop wishing. That's just the heart I wish everybody was happy, but are you all? Then how much of that is my responsibility, and how much can I even affect from your misery or about your misery? To know the limits is extraordinarily important in this time in which we rush in too quickly to save somebody from their pain. Or the other way that many of us respond is that righteousness, where the oppressed, you're oppressed, and now I'm into this crusade, righteousness, and so we give away the understanding for the empowerment of leading a crusade. This should not be happening. And it can be a crusade for one person against the oppressor, or it can be a crusade, political crusade. It can be any kind of crusade. But that's not equanimity. Crusading is crusading. It's righteousness. And may I say that there is nothing more addicting than righteousness. Because you're right. And that's what, when you're right, it's like you have the forces of God on your side, which is why the forces of God in one righteous perspective will conflict with the forces of God, because our righteousness, especially if it's religious or spiritually based, does have the forces of God on our side. But that's righteousness. That's self-enhancement. That's self-validation. That's not equanimity. That's not understanding. Understanding is the laws by which we all operate. And one of those laws is the origins of our own misery. And to see that, to live with that origin, both in ourselves and other people. So we know that when misery occurs, that the moment we move out to blame or to accuse is a false pointing, which it's an untruth, but it comes very quickly. It's a knee-jerk response. What you didn't, how come I come home and you're not? I mean, all day long we go through that, don't we? What's the origin of that turmoil, of that reactivity in our side of ourselves? To live with that origin is to begin to know true equanimity. So what equanimity begins to understand is that the limits of its own empowerment, of what it can influence and what it can't. And so effort, then, equanimity changes what we call wise effort. Wise effort then becomes, we may never be able to control life, but we can always be with what is happening. So wise effort is less towards the manipulation and influence of events, and more towards our willingness to abide with that. With that, I may not be able to control, but I can always be with this. That's a beautiful statement to work with, and it will bring you more and more into the clarity of what is under your influence and what certainly isn't. And pain is not one of them. Your pain is, your suffering is. We also begin to see, as we take this to light and to study it and to really see, is that the changing quality of happiness to unhappiness, or to acquiring and to losing, or to fame and disrepute, that these undulating factors of life are in constant movement, and that no matter where we are, even the pinnacle, they can all be in some kind of, we can get the promotion and, you know, the bonus check, and then we get cancer. I have seen families build their whole life upon retirement only to have one or the other of them die very soon into retirement. And you begin to see that equanimity is not bringing these forces of happiness and empowerment and fame and into alignment. It's not trying to maximize the positive and pleasant qualities of life. And then we reach that point and now we can relax. And that relaxation is what we call equanimity, because we're at the pinnacle of what we want in life. It's not that, because the whole thing is like an amoeba. Something goes in, comes out. It's like this whole constantly moving experience. So equanimity understands that. Equanimity doesn't rely on conditions, a set of conditions, for contentment. It has to find contentment free of conditions, because conditions are not reliable, and for the most part they are not within your influence. So again, we let the conditions go. Whatever is happening is happening. Now can I be with these? So now, can I be with these becomes the message of equanimity. Can I be with this? What does that mean? Can I be with this? Can I be with unhappiness? Can I be with a lump in my breast? Can I be with the law on my... Can I be with the lack of status and the... Can I be with that? I don't know. I don't know if you can be with it. I'm saying it can be with. It's possible to be with it. What does it take? It takes non-resistance. So equanimity is really non-resistance. Just not resisting it. Equanimity is non-reaction, so there's no fear response to what's occurring. I'm not afraid of this thing because I've lived with it, I understand it, I know it to be what it is, and there's no resistance to what it is. So the call of equanimity is the call to understand that much of our life is out of our control, and yet I can still be with it. I can still not resist it. I can still let it be as it is. Ajahn Sumedho, very senior Western monk, put it this way. The mind is like space. There is room in it for everything or nothing. We always have a perspective once we know that space of mind, its emptiness. Armies can come into the mind and leave, butterflies, rain clouds, or nothing. All things can come and go without us being caught in reaction or resistance. So equanimity is the capacity to just allow things to come and go on their own without resistance. When things come and go on their own without resistance, the heart is in control, not the mind. The mind is only in control in resistance. The mind that is not resisting is the heart. the mind comes forward in the willingness not to resist. I mean, the heart comes forward in the willingness not to resist. In the willingness not to resist, equanimity meets caring. You care. And there may not be a thing you can do about it. Care, you care about it. You care about your sore knee. You care about your hurt arm. You care about your arthritic fingers. And you go to the doctor, you see if you can do something about it. The doctor says, there's nothing I can do. You still care about it. It doesn't rob of the caring. It doesn't rob us of the affect. It doesn't rob us of the heart's play. What it robs us of is seeking refuge from the pain in some isolated, insulated space or place within us. The heart only knows to keep on caring. It will care forever, and we want it to care forever. It's what engages us. It's what allows everything to come into its rightful place. But not to back away, because very easily the mind can make conclusions about that and say, I'm not going to, because it hurts to care. Mind can make conclusions about the hurt of that caring and find a place that's so locked in insulation that it neither feels nor cares about anything. So we have to be careful that the meditation is not unbalanced in this way. It's not a place to hide. So what is equanimity in its heart of hearts? We see that the more we understand as problems arise internally or externally, the less resistance we have to a problem, the less movement we have to that problem. We're not trying to solve it. We're not trying to fix it. Because what arises in the relationship is the understanding that I can't fix it. That there's nothing I can do about anger. There's nothing I can do about fear. There's nothing I can do about impatience, accept it. And then the more I accept it, A-C-C-E-P-T, the less I move from it, and the less reaction or fear I have of it, and the more settled I become with it, and the more settled I become with it, the more I can hold it and the more space there is around it. The more space there is around it, the more capacity there is to see what it really is and to have contentment with it. And so equanimity is really in not moving. And when we give meditation instructions, non-judgmental acceptance, to be with, to just let go, release yourself, all of the different ways, we're really encouraging an equanimous non-reactivity to that particular aspect of mind or body. The only way we're ever going to get to the point where we're not moving in relationship to it is when we understand that it's basically harmless, that it holds no inherent harm for us. The worst thought, the worst, most passionate idea, the most abject terror, whole is essentially harmless. It's only harmful when I move from it, because the movement from it creates the fear of it, and it's the fear of it that creates its harm, not its essential nature. And so equanimity understands that, and so it does not move. It does not react. Not because it doesn't care. Because the less I react, the more affected I am by it. It seems paradoxical, but that is the truth. The more in touch I am with it, the more there is less of a sense of me with the experience, but just the abiding within the experience. The less dualistic and the more unified this experience becomes. But to understand the difference between that as equanimity and detachment, disinterest, disassociation, disengagement, those are all aversive responses, seeking a hiding place from, a turning away. And you can find it. You'll find the caves of the mind which will allow you to be disaffected, disinterested, disassociated, detached. But that's not life. That's not living life. That's not abiding in life. And these Brahma Viharas are said that some beings dwell in them for eons. Deeply intimate, deeply feeling, deeply receptive. Releasing any tension with the thing at all, any resistance to it. The resistance is our wanting to be protected from it. But if the thing is harmless, I don't care about being protected from something that's harmless. I can let go of that resistance. It takes an enormous amount of trust to let go of any resistance to anger or fear. It takes an enormous amount of trust. Who's going to protect me from this thing? We don't realize that it's our wanting to protect ourselves from it that is the creation of me who wants to be protected. It's that very movement of fear that is the personification and manifestation of the person who's afraid. Have no fear, we abide. There never was two. And equanimity is the manifestation of that understanding. So it's not backing away. It's not a fearful glance. It's not a seeking refuge. It's not a state of neutrality. It's not a shelter from the storm. It's not a safe harbor from the onslaught of my mind. It's open vulnerability. Standing naked, unprotected, and seeing the harmlessness of everything that arises. Can we sit for a minute or two?